Hey, it's John Canzano. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. And thanks to all the listeners and all of our sponsors who help make the Bald-Faced Truth the number one sports radio show in Portland. Enjoy.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
I want you all to listen up. This is important stuff, all right?
Okay.
The Bald-Faced Truth.
Call 503-417-7575 or 877-733-0750 or text to 64636.
Here we go in 3, 2.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth.
Radio show always surprises me. It surprises me where it takes us on every day. We script it a little bit. Like, we have a show sheet every day that the producer of the show, Gliss, does. And we'll go through the show. We usually meet after every show to kind of download on what happened in the show. And we'll talk about tomorrow's guests. I stay in contact with the production team overnight and into the morning as they're booking guests and sort of aligning up the show for the day. But the show often will go places that isn't on the show sheet. It's like that's the skeleton, but sometimes the body ends up somewhere in a different place altogether. On the show this week, on Wednesday's show, I did an interview with Austin Meek of the Eugene Register Guard. He's a phenomenal writer. He's a great columnist. I don't expect him to be in Eugene for long. I think if he had come along at a different time in the newspaper era, he would be a guy that would already be writing for the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. He's a smart writer. He has smart takes. He's a good reporter. I read Austin Meek, and I think you should as well at the Eugene Register Guard. I'm not one of those columnists that's like, don't read a guy who might be competition. I am happy to say this guy's a great columnist. You should read him. So I brought him on the radio show. What he isn't during games, and I've sat by him numerous times on Press Row, he's soft-spoken. He's quiet. I was surprised when I brought him on the radio show this week because he was outgoing. He was interesting. He had a lot to offer. He talked freely, had good energy. And I thought to myself, like, on Press Row, he's pretty quiet during the game. Like, I'm chatty during the game. Like, I remember as a kid, my dad used to tell me, hey, you have to be quiet for the next 10 minutes because we're watching the football game. He would shut me up and shut me down. Austin Meek, during a game, he mainly observes and sits quietly. And I think it's really cool. So we brought him on the show, and I didn't know what to expect. Even though that I knew him a little and had conversations with him, he had great energy. Obviously, he had great insight, but he had great energy and it was a good interview. So I'm going to play some of that interview with Austin Meek. But one of the most surprising things that came out of it wasn't that Meek was outgoing and energetic. It was where the conversation took us. Because we ended up talking about Oregon as the University of Oregon as a football or basketball school. And the conversation took off on Twitter after the interview with Austin Meek, because I posed the question, is it a football school or is it a basketball school? And people said, no, it's neither. It's track and field. Nonsense. It's not a track and field school. As it's been proven, you don't know the name of the head coach at Oregon in track and field. As it's been proven, you don't know athletes in track and field at the University of Oregon. You're not buying jerseys. You're not buying tickets to go see track meets and track events at Oregon. You're buying football tickets. You're watching that athletic department, $190 million in revenue, generated mostly by basketball and football. You're watching those things. You're not watching the other things. So don't try to sell me the University of Oregon as anything more than either a basketball or football school. I think if you're buying the future of Oregon, it's clear you buy basketball because Dana Altman's got it going. He's got traction. I think it's evident in the Pac-12 conference that they are going to be one of the top two or three or four teams in the Pac-12. In football, it's different. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of unknown. I think in part because the landscape's changed. USC's back. Stanford is there to stay. The conference is very competitive. There's great coaches. The playing field's pretty leveled out. And Oregon, which used to have advantages in uniforms and in playing fast, and they've lost those advantages. Everybody's playing fast. Everybody has a uniform. Oregon State, Washington State, everybody has uniforms. So Oregon's not doing anything special anymore. And so I think there's a lot of fascination with football and wondering what Willie Taggart's going to be. But I think if you're casting a vote for are they a football program or a basketball program, Austin Meek doesn't agree with me. But I think you're buying basketball long term. And you're very curious about where football is. But I start my interview with Austin Meek this year by asking him that question. Is it a basketball school or a football school? Listen in. Austin Meek, award-winning columnist at the Eugene Register-Guard. He is a three-time Associated Press Sports Editors Award winner this year alone. Does a terrific job covering all things Eugene. Smart columnist, great columnist, joining us now. How are you, Meek?
John, hey, I'm doing good. How are you, buddy?
Good. Let's talk, before we get to football, I got to ask about baseball. Story in the Eugene Register Guard about the baseball program sort of hemorrhaging, not, you know, losing money and losing baseball games as well. Is George Horton in trouble?
I think he is, yeah. Now, what that means, you know, exactly, I'm not sure. But they're obviously trending in the wrong direction. I mean, they set a pretty high bar there with the investment they made in the program. They've been talking about Omaha forever, but they're a long ways from that right now. And, you know, it's going in the wrong direction. You know, I don't think anybody would dispute the fact that George did a great job to build the program up from nothing, to get him to a super regional as quickly as he did. But for some reason, they plateaued, and then they've started to, every year now, take a little step backwards. And looks like they're going to miss the tournament 2 years in a row now. So, yeah, I think that's enough to put him pretty squarely on the hot seat.
Would it be nuts for Oregon to reach over to Oregon State like they did with an assistant coach? But would it be nuts for them to reach over and try to hire away one of Pat Casey's right-hand guys? Probably not Pat Bailey, who's too loyal, but somebody else, and say, look, we're going with an Oregon State guy? Could they do that?
Boy, they'd really have to swallow some pride to do that. It might be absolutely the best thing they could do. It really could make a lot of sense, because I think we've seen that the Oregon State model, compared to the model that Oregon has, has really worked for Oregon State. You know, I don't know if Oregon could bring themselves to do that at this point. Obviously, George Horton was, you know, Pat Kilkenny's hire, and you know, absolutely the best guy resume-wise that they could have hired at that time. He has a philosophy, the small ball thing. You know, he's stuck with it. He's talked every year about, oh, we're going to make some adjustments and tweak some things, but it's looked pretty much the same every year. And it obviously they need to do something different. You know, philosophically, what they're doing right now is not working for them. But man, it would be a tough pill to swallow to basically admit, you know, we built this program with the intention of competing with Oregon State, but we can't do it. So now we're going to try to go get one of their guys.
Austin Meek, Eugene Register Guard columnist, is our guest. Dana Altman, I sat by you during the run up to the Final Four. We watched this Ducks basketball team achieve and achieve and achieve. How far away is Oregon from being a basketball school? Can we say that's even a debate, or is that just kind of talk for sports radio?
Well, let's see what Willie Taggart does. You know, if Willie's winning 9 or 10 games every year, I think football is still going to drive the bus. But if it goes bad for Willie, and if Dana Altman's still got his program running at the level it's been the last couple years, then, yeah, I think, you know, I think you could see Oregon, the Oregon fan base, sort of shift its interests. You know, I do feel like this football thing is a little bit precarious. You know, a lot of fans that jumped on the bandwagon during the Chip Kelly years, and you know, we'll see how much appetite they have to stick with it if it's not immediate results with Willie Taggart. I mean, look, there's great fans here. I run into fans all the time, and you do too, who were here for the toilet bowl in the 80s and, you know, sat in the empty Autzen Stadium when the team was terrible.
Yeah, there's about 70,000 of them that tell me that they're at that game. You know, it's like, it must have been a sellout. It's interesting. I mean, Willie's done a really nice job with social media, some of the recruiting successes. You wrote a great column about, hey, doesn't Willie know it's supposed to be hard to recruit to the University of Oregon? What do you think he's doing?
He's doing what the coaches, you know, on the cutting edge of recruiting are all doing. And I think that was one of the big knocks against Mark Helfrich and his staff, is that was a pool they just didn't really want to wade into. You know, they didn't want to do the social media stuff. I think they wanted to be above that a little bit, which I understand. You know, if that were me, I would have a hard time making a living that way too as a coach, but it's what you have to do. You know, recruiting obviously is the lifeblood of a college football program. And if you want to get these kids, you got to communicate with them on their level. And I think that was one of the areas where the previous staff struggled. I think they struggled to connect with a lot of top level recruits. And so, you know, Willie's brought in a lot of energy, and a fresh approach to that. Now there's, you know, it's a long way from that to actually being able to get the kids in the program who can, you know, compete at the highest level that Oregon wants to be at. You know, it's one thing to get some, you know, some flashy commitments and, you know, get some hashtags out there that are trending. Another thing to actually build a program that can really compete at the highest level. So we'll see, I guess, how this translates for Willie on the field. But so far, you know, in terms of the recruiting rankings, it looks pretty good.
I rolled my eyes when he said he wasn't ready to declare Justin Herbert the starter. I thought, that's just a coach who's trying to challenge a kid. Is he really going to live in that space all summer and into fall camp?
I can't imagine he's going to, you know, announce a starter during the summer. I would think that it ought to wrap up pretty quickly once they come back for fall camp, because having seen the other options, I just don't know how long you can keep it going. You know, how long can you suggest to people that you have another quarterback who's capable of starting over Justin Herbert? I get what he's doing. Hey, when you're coming off 4-8, you don't want anybody to feel like, oh, my job's safe. You know, well, I did my part last year. You want everybody to feel like their job's up for grabs. But you know, clearly, as you look at it, Justin Herbert is is far and away the best quarterback they have on their team and the best chance Willie Taggart has to succeed early. I mean, you know, these two guys need each other. Willie needs Justin Herbert as much as Herbert needs Willie to buy into him. So I think it's in their mutual best interest to make this work out.
We're talking to Austin Meek, columnist Eugene Register Guard. I want to look at last year's team and go, well, if they had a better coaching staff, you know, maybe it was a 7-win team or maybe it was a 6-win team. Willie then retains some guys, brings some new bodies in. What's the upside here? What's the range if things go well, best case, worst case, that you see the talent level meriting?
Well, offensively, they're going to be pretty stacked. I like what they have offensively, you know, in the offensive line and the skill positions. I think they can score a bunch of points. But I think, you know, the ceiling on the team is going to come from the defense and the fact that I still don't see the answers there. You know, maybe Scott Pagano, the Clemson transfer, makes a big difference for them on the defensive line. Maybe Jim Levitt's scheme is so much better than Brady hopes that they have a significant improvement defensively. But I just don't think they still have the defensive talent to be more than about an 8 or 9 win team. I would set 8 or 9 wins as the ceiling and probably put the more likely scenario a little bit below that.
Thomas Tyner tells me over the weekend he's coming back. He wants to go to Oregon State. Oregon grants him the release, which they should when he asks for it. He's going to Oregon State. You got a chance to see him a little bit. Where do you think Tyner would fit at Oregon State? What's he got left?
Man, that's a great question, and I got to give you credit on that one because I was totally stunned by that. That floored me. I really thought when Thomas walked away from Oregon that he was done playing football, not because he couldn't do it, you know, just because I thought he was one of those guys who could be happy without it. But obviously, he's still got the desire to play. The physical ability, I assume, is still going to be there. But, you know, it is a question of after 2 years away, what does he have left? And you know, where does he fit with Oregon State? Knowing what I know about Gary Anderson and the culture that he has there, obviously Thomas Tyner's not going to have anything handed to him there. It's not going to be like, oh, you played at Oregon, you were a 5-star recruit, so, you know, here, come be our starting running back. He's going to have to earn some carries. And, you know, with Ryan Nall there, they've got a guy who has proven he can do it at this level too. So I think best case scenario, Thomas Tyner could absolutely be a complement to what they do and contribute. A lot of it's going to depend on just, you know, what kind of condition he comes in, how hard he's worked to get back and what he's got left in the tank.
We're talking to Austin Mate columnist Eugene Register Guard. The Dana Altman success in basketball has, you know, sent some players off early into the pro ranks. They lose three guys. They have Troy Brown Jr. coming in. You confident that Dana can stay at or near the top of the Pac-12 given the turnover?
Yeah, just because you look around the Pac-12 and how many schools really are really trying that hard. You know, how many schools do you look at and say, oh, you know, they've got a coach who I really trust, you know, to run a program year in and year out. It just seems like, you know, there's a couple schools at the top. Obviously, Arizona's got it going. You know, UCLA's been kind of hit and miss, but it seems like Alford's getting some players in there. USC, you know, they should have a pretty veteran team back, and they'll be okay. But I don't think anybody's looking at Andy Enfield like he's building a monster there. So I just think the Pac-12 is, you know, it kind of lends itself to a program like Oregon being able to be pretty consistently at the top. Dana's done a pretty good job, even when he wasn't getting the top-tier recruits, the five-star kids, the McDonald's All-Americans like Troy Brown. Even without those guys, he was able to put it together every year and, you know, somehow find a team that could get to the tournament and win a game or two and maybe even go further. So if he is able to recruit in a little higher bracket now, you know, after what they did get into the Final Four, then I think they ought to be top two or three in the Pac-12 every year. I'm going to be surprised if they're much lower than that.
Meek, you're the best. And for people who haven't read Austin Meek, get yourself to the Eugene Register Guard website and read him. He's good. Austin, thank you, man.
Hey, thanks, John. Congrats to you on your APSE stuff this year. It's great to be on with you.
For people who don't know the APSE, and you probably don't because you're a radio show listener or you're a reader, you don't give a rip about the awards that are inside baseball in the writing industry. But the Associated Press Sports Editors, they announce every year the top 10 columnists by circulation category, the top 10 beat reporters by circulation category, investigative reporting, enterprise reporting, projects, explanatory reporting. It's way inside baseball, but it's the industry standard, and people who are in the industry pay attention. Austin Meek, in his circulation category with the Eugene Register Guard, won three different categories this year. He won columnist, he won feature writing, and he wore explanatory. It's remarkable to do a double. It's really special to win in three categories in a single year against peers in that circulation category. In my career, in, you know, 20 years of writing, I've won in projects, I've won in enterprise, I've won an investigative and column writing, but not in the same year like Austin Meek did. And I think it's remarkable to have a conversation with a guy who's had that level of success where he's at. And again, like I said, a different era of newspapers where people were moving jobs every 6 months or every year, every 2 years. Austin Meek would have elevated very quickly. I think Eugene's lucky to have Austin Meek as a columnist. But I keep looking at him going, how long until you get out of there? Because there's got to be a bigger entity that is willing to make a run at Austin Meek and lure him away from the Eugene Register Guard. But until then, just enjoy him. And it, you know, it brings me, too, to a good story because Bill Plachke of the LA Times sort of cornered the market on the large circulation category Associated Press Sports Editors Award for column writing. And when I got to the Oregonian, it was Plachke was the standard, Mitch Albom at the Detroit Free Press, Sally Jenkins at the Washington Post, Joe Posnanski in Kansas City, people like that, Jason Whitlock, who had been perennial winners, were at the top of the heap. And I really went after him, and I said, I'm going to get there. And sure enough, in like 2006 or 2007, I came in second to Bill Plachke. And I'll never forget, I was at the Final Four when they announced that, and I sent Plachke a bottle of champagne, bottle of Dom. I bought a nice bottle of champagne, and I sent it to his room, and I said, hey, you know, congratulations to you. You were first. I was second, whatever. He didn't know I was really trying to kill brain cells. I finished second to Plachke 2 years in a row, and it wasn't until the third year after two bottles of champagne that I finally beat him and won the category. But it, to me, it was like very gratifying. Like, I'm not an awards person. All the awards that I've ever won are in boxes in my garage. I don't hang them on the walls at my house. My wife has two Emmys. We put those up because Emmys are just the sweetest, coolest looking thing ever. Looks like an Oscar. But the awards I put in the box at home. But I'll tell you, like, I thought, like, beating Plachke, that was a big deal to me. Like beating the guy from the LA Times. You're at the Oregonian and you beat the guy from the LA Times. And so went to the awards ceremony and got up there and they gave me the plaque and everything. And then I was feeling pretty good about myself, you know, and I looked down and on the plaque it says Joe Canzano from the Oregonian. And I was like, you know what? Just when you think you've made it, you get a reminder, you ain't nothing. All right, I want you to leave it here. Coming up, we've got In the Wake of the Week. If you missed any of this radio show from the week, we will not only keep you humble on the show, but we will keep you on top of things. In the Wake of the Week is basically producer Gliss's opportunity to flex his muscles and show how good he is at booking guests. We've had a great week of guests. You'll hear that next coming up on the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
Hey, yeah, I want to shoot, baby, shoot.
This is the Bald-Faced Truth.
All right, it's time for you to make a commitment. Yeah, we've arrived at that portion of the week, that time of the week, where, like, all week long, we put this radio show together for you. We try to bring the energy. We book the best guests. We try to have the content be as compelling and interesting and relevant as possible. Thomas Tyner, for example, the Oregon State running back, he made no other media appearances publicly than on this show. He talked to nobody else. I talked to his dad this week. He said, that's the only interview he's doing. He's coming on your show. So we get that kind of content on the show. We commit to you. Producer Gliss and Alabama Adriana and Dustin and Curtis Rogers and the team we have here and all the interns and the production people that we have working on the show. We podcast the shows. Basically, I say we tee it up for you all week long so that you can get an escape from your work week, your kids, your taxes, whatever ails you, whatever you need an escape from. We're here for you. But we do that for you. So in return, I ask very little, but I'm going to ask something of you now. I want you, if you're listening in a vehicle or listening wherever you are, to make a commitment back to us, whatever station you're listening to us on, wherever you may be, just reach out and give us one of your presets. If it's not already like number one or number two, we should be in the top two on your presets. Make it number one or two and make us your go-to when you go to look for sports radio. Because I'm telling you, and I said it all week long, I do not take it for granted that you're out there listening. We do this show for you. I often say I do the show that I want to do. I said that when I got in this business, that I wasn't going to conform to what everybody else wanted the show to be about. I wasn't going to do typical sports radio. If I wanted to talk about medicine, I'd talk about medicine. If I wanted to talk about politics, I would talk about it, although I'm not that interested in it right now. But you know, I always said that, and I always said, too, that I would never take the privilege of having this show for granted and having the ability to speak with you and debate with you and make you feel and make you think. So make that preset commitment back by just reaching out. There you go. Reach out and do it and just hold that button down till it beeps at you. And we are now your go-to. See, that's how you do that. And we'll be there for you. You'll be there for us. That's how it works here. All right. Producer Gliss and the team every week put together a montage of the best sound from all week long. And it's a segment that we like to call In the Wake, Wake of the Week, 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 Week.
Get him on the show.
I would just hope people see the rationale and the reasoning behind a kid deciding that he's going to chase his dream and not live with regret. And joining us now on the phone is Thomas Tyner, now apparently headed to Oregon State. Let's go back for people who, you know, haven't followed this story from the beginning. You out of high school, you decide to go to the University of Oregon. Was that a difficult decision to you? Did you consider Oregon State at that time?
Yeah, it was a difficult decision for me. I always grew up going to Oregon State games, and they were actually the first school to contact me. Then I ended up going to Oregon, but it was definitely a difficult decision.
The decision to medically retire, was that a tough one for you?
Yeah, definitely. Just ending my career like that was, you know, that's something that no kid ever thought he would have ever done. You know, they always have dreams of going to the NFL, and that was definitely my dream. And for me to do that, definitely just crushed me. I never thought that would have happened.
The decision to come back, you know, and I talked to you over several months in which I kind of felt like there were some days where I felt like you would come back. There were other days when I thought, well, he's enjoying fishing and hunting and being a college kid. At what point did you go, I have to do this.
It's always been on my mind, and I think as I got closer to graduating, that's when life started to hit me. And you know, I gotta make a move. Like, what am I gonna do? Am I gonna go work? Am I gonna try and play football again? And I think I really made this decision for myself, and I felt like I needed to do this, and I owed myself, and I wanted to see how far I can take my athleticism, and so I definitely owe this to myself.
You see Ryan Nall there. Were there any other universities that you thought, hey, I could transfer here or there, or Mike Riley's at Nebraska, or was it Oregon State or bust?
It was definitely Oregon State or bust. I've always loved watching Beavers play. As I said before, I grew up watching them play, and I love the way they run things down there. And I just felt like this was a very unique opportunity, and I just had to take it.
Have you talked to Ryan Nall about it, or did you get a note from him?
I haven't talked to him at all, but it's kind of funny. I went to the state championship game, the 6A Westland Central Catholic game, and I ended up going, and I didn't know I was sitting next to his mom, and then he actually came down and sat there, and I was like, oh crap, that's Ryan Nolan, and we talked for a little bit, and we met each other for the first time, and he's a great guy, and he's a great, obviously a great football player, and I can't wait to play with him.
How did it feel to have it on Saturday go public? You know, I put it on Oregon Live, it's out there on Twitter, suddenly it's out there, Thomas Tyner's coming back. Was that a relief, or does that put pressure on you?
Neither. It is what it is, and this was my decision. And, you know, I don't like listening to other people and what they have to say. It's irrelevant. And this move is for myself, and that's all I'm focused on right now.
Gary Anderson, did you get to have a conversation with him yet about becoming a Beaver?
Yeah, I actually talked to him. I think it was the day of
Saturday.
It was a Saturday. Saturday. We had a good conversation, and he's stoked, and so am I. And we look forward to getting to work together.
Thomas Tyner, newest Oregon State running back, is our guest. How do you think you fit with Ryan Nall?
I think we'll complement each other nicely. He's a great back. He has great open field capability. He can run through you, and he has great vision. I had an opportunity to watch him play these past 2 years sitting out, and I think we get in the backfield together, we will complement each other nice.
Get him on the show.
Everybody giving Thomas Tyner a hard time. I shouldn't say everybody. A thin stripe of Duck fans are giving Thomas Tyner a hard time about going to Oregon State. Again, going to Oregon's not an option to him. He's medically retired. He can't go back there. Mike Parker, he's a Duck, who is voice of the Beavers. He's joining us now. How are you, sir?
You know, John, thanks for having me on. I know Bill Clinton once parsed whatever your definition of is. When you say he is, I think it's better to say was.
Was. You know, okay.
I like how you got the part right, though. I am the voice of the Beavers and looking forward to a 19th year, which is suddenly taking an intriguing turn in football. It's been a great run in baseball, but this Thomas Tyner story is intriguing to be sure. Congratulations on your part in breaking it. I was getting beat up in the press box Saturday during the broadcast of the Beaver-Washington State baseball game when you were beginning to break the news. People are throwing phones in front of me. Did you see this? I'm trying to call the 1-1 breaking ball outside ball two, and all I'm seeing is Thomas Tyner. So you made my day very interesting on Saturday.
I told Thomas Tyner, because it's like 10 a.m. on Saturday morning, and he says, okay, I'm ready to go public with this, and, you know, I'm writing the story, and I'm ready to hit publish. And he says, I want to talk to my dad before you hit publish, right? So he wants to talk to his dad, which I'm glad he has his dad in his corner.
Sure.
But I eventually texted him, because I hadn't heard back from him for like 20 minutes. So I said, Thomas, I need to mow my lawn. So we need to move forward here. Like, let's go. Mike, when you see Thomas Tyner to the Beavers, it creates such an interesting backfield. Ryan Nall, Tyner, I think this is one of the most compelling off seasons we've ever had.
I agree, John. And you know, I hope. I mean, I can understand, like you said, it's a slim band of maybe, you know, people who aren't happy about the development. But I hope most people, if you pull back and take a look, as you phrased it and as Thomas has shared with you, the idea of having no regrets, not, you know, I mean, 2 years out of the game, and the itch, the urge, the desire to, you know, to want to get back at it again, I hope most people can respect that and respect the young man's effort for coming back to try to play. And as you said, he couldn't return to where he was before, and he's always had, as you shared with you, a fondness for Oregon State. And you know, there was even a time when the Beavs were very much in it, maybe even his first choice at one point in the whole process years ago. So, you know, maybe for him it's a homecoming type feel in his own heart and a fit that might be a little better for him to end, you know, his career on. I think it has a chance to be just a great story from that standpoint, that a young man 2 years out gets an urge to play again and has an opportunity to. So I hope indeed it happens as we wait still for the official word here. But as far as how it affects Oregon State's running game, I mean, you talk about Nall and Pierce and the transfer from TCU and Travoris Johnson and the possibility of Thomas. That's a pretty good backfield right there, John. And I think, it, you know, Gary Anderson already had a lot of momentum going. If this piece does indeed fall into place, that's pretty good stuff.
Get him on the show.
Austin Meek, he is a three-time Associated Press Sports Editors Award winner this year alone. Does a terrific job covering all things Eugene. Smart columnist, great columnist, joining us now. How are you, Meek?
John, hey, I'm doing good. How are you, buddy?
Good. Dana Altman, I sat by you during the run-up to the Final Four. We watched this Ducks basketball team achieve and achieve and achieve. How far away is Oregon from being a basketball school? Can we say that's even a debate, or is that just kind of talk for sports radio?
Well, let's see what Willie Taggart does. You know, if Willie's winning 9 or 10 games every year, I think football's still going to drive the bus. But if it goes bad for Willie, and if Dana Altman's still got his program running at the level it's been the last couple years, then yeah, I think, you know, I think you could see Oregon, the Oregon fan base, sort of shift its interest. You know, I do feel like this football thing is a little bit precarious. You know, a lot of fans that jumped on the bandwagon during the Chip Kelly years. And, you know, we'll see how much appetite they have to stick with it if it's not immediate results with Willie Taggart. I mean, look, there's great fans here. I run into fans all the time, and you do too, who were here for the Toilet Bowl in the 80s and, you know, sat in the empty Austin Stadium when the team was terrible.
Yeah, there's about 70,000 of them that tell me that they're at that game. You know, it's like, it must have been a sellout.
Yeah, they probably, probably a few who have embellished those memories a little bit over the years. But, you know, the basketball thing, I think it can catch on. But if Oregon fans have their choice, if they've got good football, that's still going to be number one.
You wrote a great column about, hey, doesn't Willie know it's supposed to be hard to recruit to the University of Oregon? What do you think he's doing?
Well, he's doing what the coaches, you know, on the cutting edge of recruiting are all doing. And I think that was one of the big knocks against Mark Helfrich and his staff, is that was a pool they just didn't really want to wade into. You know, they didn't want to do the social media stuff. I think they wanted to be above that a little bit, which I understand. You know, if that were me, I would have a hard time making a living that way too as a coach, but it's what you have to do. You know, recruiting obviously is the lifeblood of a college football program, and if you want to get these kids, you got to communicate with them on their level. And I think that was one of the areas where the previous staff struggled. I think they struggled to connect with a lot of top level recruits, and so, you know, Willie's brought in a lot of energy and a fresh approach to that. Now, there's, you know, it's a long way from that to actually being able to get the kids in the program who can, you know, compete at the highest level that Oregon wants to be at. You know, it's one thing to get some, you know, some flashy commitments and, you know, get some hashtags out there that are trending. Another thing to actually build a program that can really compete at the highest level. So we'll see, I guess, how this translates
for Willie on the field, but so far, you know, in terms of the recruiting rankings, it looks pretty good.
Get him on the show.
Jeremy Wu is our guest. SI.com covers the NBA and the draft. The Blazers have three picks, none of them better than 15. They're at 15, 20, and 26. After those first two guys, it just feels like it's a lot of, well, who knows? Well, how do you see that next portion of the draft, and where does the next, you know, tier of talent sort of break off for you?
Sure, yeah. I do think there's a lot of interesting players in the lottery where maybe they aren't going to become superstars, but there are a lot of guys who have what I think is a very good chance of becoming, you know, guys who have long careers, who are have clear paths to, you know, contributing in the NBA. And I think that probably there's a good dozen or so guys who I feel good about for sure. But I think that the talent well in the draft, you know, runs pretty deep. Beyond that, I think there's probably, honestly, 40 to 50 players who I think, like, are pretty good prospects, more so than in the past couple of years. Guys who, you know, have clear strengths and interesting fits. So I don't think the Blazers are at a disadvantage by way they're picking, if anything. They'll have interesting decisions to make as far as roster spots and, you know, if they're going to guarantee three guys' contracts, you know, who, they'll probably take a guy, stash it, receives, make the numbers work. You know, they have an interesting position for sure.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of an interesting thing because I think a lot of fans don't realize that first-round draft pick is a three-year commitment that you're making to a guy. And, you know, sometimes it's not great to have two picks in the 20s. How hard is it going to be for them to try to move up in this draft? Or how high can you go with traction in this draft? Can you get as high as 3, 4, 5? Or are those teams holding those picks tightly?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think if they did want to move up, say, into the top 10, they would have to dangle something else. And I don't know that Portland has the, you know, the other types of assets to make a deal like that necessarily in terms of, you know, contracts that would be attractive to a team that is rebuilding, I guess, if you put it that way. So I don't know how high they'd be able to package those picks. I mean, they could maybe move up into like the early tens if they felt the need to do that. I don't know if it'd be worth it though. Like, I think they'll be a good player for them there at 15, and they'll have some good options in the 20s too.
Get him on the show.
Ben Golliver covers the NBA for SportsIllustrated.com, joining us. How are you, Golliver?
I'm good, John. I heard you were talking about sports regrets. You know, I'm down here in San Antonio, and I swear the entire media contingent has one giant regret, and it's that Kevin Durant chose to go to the Warriors, and we don't have a good series to cover.
Is it boring for you, or how hard do you have to work to watch the game and be interested?
Well, look, I'm in this so deep, John. Like, it could be 100-0, and I'd still be trying to find ways to make it interesting. I think I'm, you know, past the point of being able to be saved or salvaged. But I understand why casual fans are a little bit frustrated. I mean, how shocking was Boston winning, you know, just to get one game? I mean, it's like, let's throw them a parade because they were able to beat LeBron once on, like, his worst game in 3 years, you know? And it's kind of a similar mood down here in San Antonio. Their fan base is great, but, you know, they're leaving halfway through the fourth quarter because they realize without Kawhi Leonard, I mean, what's their answer to four All-Stars that are starting for Golden State?
Yeah, are you saying this is bad for the NBA, or is it good for the NBA to have super teams?
You know, I think, you know, it's a mixed blessing. I mean, usually, and we'll probably best off making that determination after we see the TV ratings for the finals, because I'm assuming they're going to be through the roof. But the NBA has long tried to make the case that they want to have competitive balance. They want to have most teams feeling like they have a shot. And I'm not sure that many teams this year felt like they had a shot. You look at some of the moves that a lot of teams made in terms of, you know, not taking on salary, not really loading up, and almost just punting, you know, at times during the season. And, you know, that's frustrating to watch. And I look at a team like Boston, and they had a real chance at the trade deadline to make a move to add some star power, guys like Jimmy Butler or Paul George. They don't do it, and why are we surprised they can't compete with the loaded Cleveland Cavaliers in the conference finals? So, you know, I think, you know, going forward, you know, Cleveland's not going anywhere. You know, Golden State's not going anywhere. And I think this is a big summer to kind of watch, you know, which teams are really willing to compete for now, or are they just going to try to wait these super teams out? That's a question that I can't really remember ever being asked, you know, over the last decade when I've been covering the NBA. I can't ever remember that being part of the equation. Like, oh, should we try to win next year's title, or should we wait 5 years? I mean, that seems so anti-competitive and backwards. And I think if you're Adam Silver, that's the last thing you want. I mean, you don't want this to turn into a two-team league, and I think right now that's where they're sort of at.
Ben Golliver covers the NBA for SI.com. Ben, let's fix the NBA. You and I are sitting around. We're on an advisory committee. How do we fix what's wrong here, and what's wrong is it. We knew at the beginning it was coming to the Warriors and the Cavs.
Yeah, we really did, and I think one of the things that's been kind of sticking in my craw lately has been this All-NBA voting. I don't know if you've been staying up on that in terms of how it triggers these contract incentives. So guys like Paul George and Gordon Hayward, they're all-stars for sure, and they're small market guys, you know, in Indiana and Utah. They did not qualify for the All-NBA teams this year, so their home teams now no longer have the ability to pay them, like, really, really monstrous amounts of money, you know, $200 million-plus dollars to stay in town. And now they're more potentially available either for a trade, like for Paul George this summer, or as a free agent target for a guy like Gordon Hayward, who is a free agent this summer. That's not good. I mean, if you're the NBA, the only thing you want to see less than having your entire regular season dominated by two teams is have some of these other contenders sort of pick off these small market stars from places like Indiana and Utah and really undercutting your competitive balance. I mean, Adam Silver is going to have a lot to answer for at his finals press conference, and I guarantee you the number one thing everyone's going to want to talk about is competitive balance. And the Blazers are an interesting example. I mean, they spent through the nose last summer to try to give themselves a chance. It didn't work out, and now they're stuck, and they have to decide, well, do we tear this thing down, or do we take another shot with it next year? And those are very difficult decisions, and, you know, unfortunately, even in a best-case scenario, like if they were able to add another star this summer and offload some of these bad contracts.